Okay. I maybe think
so. McLuhan, I think, can take today. There's that poker game. He says we can now, in the global theater, retrieve any previous human event that we want. The whole human past is our repertory, and the global theater will use anything from the past as its content, you know, like seven of them a week. That's what I'm thinking of, that quote. Is that what he's saying? That we're going to retrieve some part of the past, but it'll be a movie or a TV show or a news event, and it'll blip by. We won't have to live it for 6 years like they did in history. Is that
something like that? Yeah, that what's happening now is that our history is being conserved somehow as best as it can to as much of it as possible be reflected now, because we're like approaching some kind of transcendental object that caused all of it in reverse, almost as if we have all these deeds that take us traveling back in time so that we can have the pre-effect of experiencing living a kind of a pseudo-eternity, Akashic Records dreamland, because that's actually what's in the mail right around the corner. But also, in the sense of, like, now is a time when we can retrieve anything, in McKenna terms, I think that would be caused by, because this time wave is constructed out of the same pattern at a whole bunch of levels, and the pattern is taken out of the, at least to McKenna at the time, I'm not an expert on this, but it was the oldest known sequence of the I Ching, and, oh yeah, like the tetradic thing is taken care of because it's a sequence of 64 hexagrams, so the wave packet, the original, like, wave form that's repeated on all these scales has 64 movements to it. However, the movements are determined by not the hexagrams themselves, but the intervals between them, which is how many of the lines change over to the next hexagram. And the thing is that the last two packets, like the like 63rd and 64th hexagrams in the sequence of the I Ching, are an exact reversal of each other, and there's like two reversals in a row, and so in terms of the time wave, that would mean flat. I think that seems to clash with what I just said somehow, that, like, because every line on the hexagram reverses itself, it creates no effect, and so what that is interpreted by the McKennas to mean that as we approach the end of the time wave, when there will be a time when the largest scale of wave gets into this final zone where there's no change between the last two hexagrams, or there's total change which balances itself out somehow. The point is, they say that in the last zone of any given wave, it is not affecting the manifestation of the waves below it, because the greater wave is built out of the interference factor and the mutual distortion back and forth of laying this same wave on top of itself. But because the last hexagram has a kind of a zero value, or the last change has a zero value, then the large-scale wave will not be distorting what's going on the smaller-scale waves. So, in a sense, that could almost be like a God is dead kind of intuition. Like, this giant scale of order that used to shape us is no longer giving its input. And then, shorter on a smaller wave in our time, it's like Rai is gone, or the android meme is dead. And then, down to the very last seconds of the time wave would be something like, there's no difference between physic and psychic anymore.
Perfect. Followed every word, then. I was thinking of Rai, and then you said it. I was thinking of the android meme. It's the pentatic. It's on the edge of the hexatic, or it's the AP over the AM. The something, yeah. The, and then now Croker describes the chip landscape as a flat surface thing that the consumers of it are indifferent to. And so that level of flatness is accurate about the Android meme. So we're watching the after image of the Android meme since the 90s. And it's a nothing, but it's all we have while we wait, like extras in your movie, in your dream. And it has no impact anymore, definitely since 2000, because we're in a post-information society. And what McKenna was describing in the time wave is the exact description of the conditions we relate to the Android meme, or in our relationship to it. That we are bigger than the Android meme, but we're stuck in a limbo, allowing it to finish its cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that is what you seem to be saying to me.
Yep, and part of McKenna's rap was a vision of technology, or technology of the future, or something, as he really took seriously the miniaturizing trend.
Yeah.
And he basically felt, or hoped, that it would miniaturize to the point of becoming invisible in its hardware aspect, and everything we know of as our technology would basically manifest to us as innate skills that we had added on to our senses and our physical abilities, and yet in our sort of software experience of the world there wouldn't need to be any of the of this big clunky hardware doing it. There wouldn't need to, like, we could live in a more Edenic paradise as some kind of superhumans, semi-quasi-lucid dreamers.
Right. The
with our technology being fully innate.
Yes, the Evergreens do a series in the late 90s, 99, 2000. They do like 6 or 8 hours on the millennium and what's going to happen in the next 100 years. And they say to the people attending the public reading that everything you see as you look around the room and out on the street, every technology you see will have disappeared in 100 years.
Hmm.
It will be, you'll be using, it's exactly what you described, you'll be having all the effects of that technology, but you won't see them.
Hmm.
They'll be totally miniaturized, internalized, and part of your sensory or apparatus, and won't even be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Mm, yeah. It is. It is just like along with his rap there.
Yeah.
And so Terrence McKenna was another thing I knew about him was he was smart enough to figure out his own life situation to kind of reflect that fact, which was he lived in Hawaii on the Big Island. I understand that. I think you said it was. I wasn't sure which one, but I think you said you heard it was the Big Island?
Yes.
So he lived in Hawaii, and so his thing was that he lived kind of in the bush. Like, he didn't live in Honolulu or anything, but that he had a very powerful satellite internet connection. So kind of a real, he had a real, a strong example of a very voluntary ESP with regards to the media. Like, in his life, he was living in a kind of a tropical paradise, minimal technology, but he had the internet connection.
Yeah, and he was plugged in, and I certainly wouldn't be comfortable living here without the internet.
Hmm.
You know, you'd be back in the 80s, you know, and it'd be boring. You wouldn't have your chip-bought in TV landscape. I don't need to go to New York City. It's all in my computer.
Yeah.
And it really makes it easy here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the internet, he had that 10 years ago, I guess, or 8 years. He died in 2000, so he was probably having a good time from 96 to 99.
Mm-hmm.
Because the internet was okay.
And so he recorded on tape, I think, and I guess the best of them were transcribed, did a couple of some tapes and books with Rupert Sheldrake and Ralph Abraham, who was like primarily a fractal geometer. And
The main co-writer.
On that kind of thing.
Yeah, the main co-writer, William Aaron Thompson, the last 5 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And Abraham collaborated all over the place?
Oh, yeah. Abraham, have you seen Thompson's book, Transforming History?
No, not that one.
That's his curriculum for high school, for all classes, you know, from primary up, because Steve Warner, I think his name was. No, Steve Ross was the head guy for Time Warner or something in the 80s or so. And he died. And his widow had all these millions or billions, and she was living out in the East Hamptons or somewhere out there in Long Island, and she decided that her daughter needed better education. So she started a school for her daughter. And all the other rich kids started coming. So she needed a curriculum. So when I was hanging out with Bill Thompson in the 90s, and when he came to New York twice a year, he had this other project. He didn't talk much about it, but we found out about it because Vanity Fair wrote an article on it, you know, in 96, 97 period. And William Irwin Thompson and Ralph Abraham were hired to create a curriculum for the school, for the billionaire. And they did that, and I heard the school grew, and Thompson and Abraham aren't involved anymore, but it's like overflowing with computers, as I heard a few years ago. Maybe got out of hand. But Thompson, in creating the curriculum, used some ideas from Ralph that he didn't know about before. It helped him organize it. Abraham, and you know, you've read enough Thompson, he goes through the five phases of evolution, cultural evolution. Well, he had left out the algebraic phase in late, just before the year 1000 AD and then after, right? That period of the Arab influence. And Ralph gave him the algebraic point, the algebraic mentality. And and so he spells this out in a in the book, Transforming History, but I've heard over the last couple of years that he and Ralph are doing a new book on the history of math. And
Yeah,
with the Thompson-McLuhan interfacing with Abraham's stuff.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So, okay, and Abraham was a long time, you know, the book Imaginary Landscape, one of the five people he does in that book is Ralph Abraham.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and Ralph Abraham has been, is a long time member of Lindisfarne, you know, Thompson's fellowship, his association. You know, it had Lynn Margulis, James Lovelock,
Cool, that's very good to hear.
Right, so now you're, and I've seen those books, McKenna Talking to Sheldrake and Abraham. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you want to say about them?
Well, I only just found out earlier this year that there's two of them. I thought there was only one. I've never read the first one, but I found the second one in a used bookstore, and so then I was reading it, and they take turns beginning the setting the topic with a little speech, and then they go back and forth on it. And one of the, not the first thing, but one of the first things that McKenna chooses to talk about is Hawaii itself, specifically the evolutionary process as kind of happening in an accelerated way there, or being more explicit as if it's like the laboratory, whereas all the rest of the world is so complicated by having these giant land masses and all this interaction that Hawaii is a bit more of a, not totally sterile, but a bit more of an isolated and sterile environment in which to study the evolutionary process, especially because the constant streaming out of material through that tallest mountain in the world there, like McKenna mentioned, that, you know, you think Everest might be the tallest, its peak might be the highest above sea level, but as a structure, the big island of Hawaii is the tallest mountain in the world because it starts on the ocean floor. And that it is, and that Hawaii, the chain of islands, is literally like the spewings, it's like a little, it's like the puffy smoke clouds of this streaming of material out from the, you know, not necessarily the center of the Earth, but wherever, underneath the ocean, constantly streaming out, forming an island, it breaks away, another island is formed, it breaks away, another island is formed, it breaks away. And that you can see, apparently, according to McKenna, you can see, and Sheldrake, as a biologist, is fascinated, you can see species exhibiting variations from island to island, even though none of the islands are really all that old, so that you can see instances where populations were separated by lava flows that then turned into rivers that then eroded to make separate islands or something, and that the populations being separated so frequently by the volcanic flows made evolution happen there, at least to our eyes and the evolutionary record there, happening much faster on a faster scale than we see elsewhere in the world, where things are a little bit more muddled up with everything else.
Right. So, is he saying that the four or five islands that make up Hawaii, like Maui, Oahu, the Big Island, and there's another one begins with K? I'm just learning them; haven't got them all memorized yet. The whole group of islands is the tallest mountain structure, or one particular island?
He wasn't as specific. He kind of mentioned the tallest mountain thing as an aside. And I guess I don't know the real structure of how connected all those islands are to the ocean floor, or if it's even possible for them to just be floating there stably or something. So, or how, to what degree they're connected underneath the water. So I'm not really sure about all that, but just that they were created kind of in sequence by that there's a constant streaming out at that point. And
yeah,
that's also... that, you know, that's not just a supposition, because the I haven't verified this on you know, Google Maps or anything for myself. I'm just taking people's word for it. But Hawaii is apparently at the latitude which corresponds to, if you put a tetrahedron inside a sphere, and if you put a giant tetrahedron inside the Earth so that the corners are touching the surface, and you put the peak of the little pyramid tetrahedron at the North Pole, then it's the latitude of 19.5 is where the 19.5 degrees is where the corners, the other three corners, would be touching the surface, and that's the latitude that Hawaii is at, and that every planet, presumably, but especially noticeable in the gas giant planets, because it's they're fluid, they can exhibit it very easily, that at that same latitude there are disturbances or storms. The Great Red Spot on Jupiter is at that latitude, and apparently there have been detected storms on all the other gas giants at that same latitude. That it's basically there is a physical principle that causes a upwelling of energy on a sphere that is turning, that it has something to do with angular momentum, and that there would be a streaming of energy at that latitude, something to do with the relationship of a tetrahedron to a sphere, that in relation to the axis it's spinning on at that latitude, there will be an energy upwelling. So when I heard that you were going, that you had moved to Hawaii, I thought of Terence McKenna immediately, but I hadn't heard all of this stuff about that latitude, and I hadn't read the trilogue where he talks about the biology and the evolutionary stuff of there. I hadn't read all of that yet. I just thought, he's gone to where Terence McKenna was.
What'd you say?
Good choice.
Yeah.
Moving to Maui. I immediately thought, no, that's smart. If New York City is the only place to be, if you're going to bother to be in North America or something, live in New York, Hawaii is pretty much one of the only other places on the short list for worth going to.
Right. I remember seeing Terence McKenna speak in New York around 94, 95, and he talked about New York City being the ultimate concrescence. You know, he used that word, right? That concept. The ultimate concrescence.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in the ultimate concrescence, and that to me is the Atlantic Ocean, the 22 gang, European, and then you go to the Pacific Ocean, which is fluid, maybe the opposite. Yes, for Lemuria, if you got Atlantis in the Atlantic Ocean, they were the hardware guys, and Lemuria wasn't so hardware, it happened before Atlantis, then our modern image of Pacific Ocean fits the Lemurian or 14 sensibility. Yeah, if you want to do Lemuria, go to Hawaii. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
So the, and if you want to do the 80s, go to Toronto. You know, Toronto was the best place in the 80s. In the 90s, in the 90s it was New York City. That's gone. Now go where Bob went, where Bob's going, where Bob is, Maui, perfect timing, showing up at the right place at the right time. You read the trilogues after hearing I was going to Maui or went to Maui, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you noticed the whole top mountain, biggest mountain in the world is here, and you noticed that that was my sign in my quadrant, mountain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm right beside this mountain called Haleakala. And we went up there a couple of days ago. I'm just taking my time getting to know Maui and that. I've been here for 3 months and spend every day at the beach in the morning and every evening in a pool. So I'm taking my time to find out what's going on. But after 3 months, I'm learning a bit. And so we went up the top of the mountain last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, and there at the top, there's an observatory and everything, and then there's a public park for tourists, and it says that it's 500 feet higher than Mount Everest there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so from the bottom of the sea floor, to the top of Haleakala, it's 29,000-something, whereas Mount Everest, which is its sea floor, is earth level, or ground level, or sea level yeah. up, it's 29,500 feet less than Haleakala. So they point out that this is the tallest, I don't know if they say that, but I take it as I'm standing on the tallest pile of rock in the world. And I'm interested if...
it's cooled lava.
Yeah. And so lava is not rock? Is that what you're saying?
Well, just it's cooler than any old rock.
Right, right. So when McKenna says the tallest mountain is maybe Hawaii, maybe the whole group. Now, I don't know, maybe there's an observatory over in Big Island. They got a high hill there that's taller than the one in Maui. I don't know. But I'm assuming this is the tallest one here in Haleakala. And so I live...
Okay, yeah, I don't know precisely.
Yeah, so... I hadn't thought of the mountain aspect until you pointed out to me that the chart prophesied my fate, because I'm sitting on the side of the tallest mountain. So I'm at the top of the world, and I'm at the center of the world. I mean, you actually look at a map, Pacific Ocean is like five times bigger than the Atlantic Ocean, you know? And you have this little dot right in the middle of it, like a navel, and it's 2,000 miles from anywhere, any land. So the interesting thing is that as Bob Marshall was here in 99 or something, I've been in Hawaii, I was here in 71 and in 83, I think that was it, twice. And but Bob Marshall was here in the late 90s, I think, and he told me that the healing properties of Maui were incredible. He got real healthy real fast. And
all right.
He said, so what I was telling him about being in Maui when I came here. I came in the third time was in November. So this is the fourth time in Hawaii, 6 months later. But in November, I felt, got healed a lot. And so I find out that volcanic rock, Carolyn had, there's a masseuse here, an incredible masseuse who does every method, but one of the parts she does is rub you with volcanic rock, because she says the magnetism or the constituents of it are incredibly healing. So I'm walking around on this volcanic rock every day, swimming in salt water, which is supposed to be incredible for you, and twice a day, and living on the vibration here, like Bob Marshall said, there's some kind of vibe here. And it would be, if it's true that the volcanic rock has extra something, minerals and stuff in it, it's radiating all through the whole place here. So it's a very, could be a very powerful place. So,
well, apparently it, I don't want to go on at length about this at all, because I really don't know with enough precision what I'm talking about, but apparently the whole reason why there would be an energy upwell at this latitude of this tetrahedral point has to do with the idea of energy coming from a kind of a everywhere dimension.
Yeah.
That tying back into James Clerk Maxwell's original equations, which are not the ones that people learn as Maxwell's equations, and his being caught up in a milieu of like geometry of Riemann, particularly,
yeah,
which was, I believe, coming up with a four-dimensional shapes and that kind of thing,
yeah,
and that Maxwell used these terms called quaternions, which are basically a pair of pairs of numbers.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a double, like basically a tetrad structure,
yeah,
of a number, and that it had something to do with there being an everywhere dimension that you can get extra energy from if you've got enough angular momentum. And apparently, or reportedly anyway, one of the famous weird physics researchers, I think it was Brian De Palma, his brother of the film director,
yeah,
that he did an experiment apparently where he tested like shooting a ball out of a tube and mapping the, you know, Newtonian path, the trajectory of how high it goes up and where it falls, but that he also then shot a ball out of a tube at the same thrust of shooting it out of the tube, but the ball was spinning incredibly fast, and that it apparently went higher and farther than the other ball, which would be impossible under Newtonian mechanics. It wouldn't matter whether it was spinning, but apparently there's something about if you've got enough angular momentum and, you know, as a planet, the mass adds in. It doesn't have to be spinning at thousands of times a second. If you've got enough angular momentum, you get extra energy from hyperspace. And so Hawaii could be the spot on Earth to be bathing in hyperspatial energy.
Okay, so 2 points there. You mentioned Riemann and the Riemannian quaternions. I don't know. You mentioned the Riemann.
I mentioned Riemann, but I didn't not know other name.
The particle, the quaternion.
Oh, the quaternion.
Quaternion, yeah. It's interesting. Maxwell is one of the bad guys from LaRouche's point of view. But LaRouche says Maxwell covers up Riemann and, you know, deflects from the Riemann contribution. So if LaRouche didn't know that the Maxwell had this other secret side that isn't popularized,
then how I learned it was that Maxwell was a Riemannian, but the Maxwellians who came along after he died and edited his manuscripts down to something more comprehensible were the ones that took the fourth dimension and the quaternions out of his writing.
Right.
Out of his math.
So LaRouche may be wrong on Maxwell in particular, not knowing what the Riemann stuff maybe does, but let's assume he doesn't. But LaRouche is right that the anti-Riemann Aristotelian forces will make sure there's no evidence of Riemann in any breakthrough that Maxwell represented. So he's confirmed that they did edit out the Riemann part, which he says is the conspiracy.
We might be able to take LaRouche specifically to school on that, if it matters. I mean,
yeah,
moving one name from the bad guy to the good guy side, like, does that really do?
Yeah, that's right. But it supports the larger principle that they do all their best to the Maxwellians, the bureaucrats of the Royal Academy, the Royal Society, make sure that Riemann continues to be ignored, you know, and erase him. Now, Kigge is on all slack raving about algebra as opposed to Riemannian geometry. That's his thing right now. So maybe Kigge's on a breakthrough, on the edge of a big discovery.
Well, I hope that if he, I'm sure that he would be, eager for the ammunition to bash Thompson over having to have been schooled by Abraham on the algebra, that Thompson would be missing the algebraic in his comprehensive survey or something, but that I would hope he would be charitable enough to, notice that the guy is totally working on correcting his oversight.
Yes.
Collaborating with Abraham.
Yeah, I don't think you'll be able to point that out to Kiki, since he blames you for a lot of stuff. He did it today at Observin as a Canadian geometric virus and a Thompson dupe, blah, 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 right?
So no, I didn't read it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he can, you know, I just hope that he can remember sometimes that he's bashing ad absurdum and not, you know, not the guy who's putting that on.
Right.
I know everything I'm talking about. I'm talking to him right now is what I mean. Like, I hope he listens to this.
Yes, I think he will. The other point is that you talk about this 19.5 factor of Hawaii and its latitude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, have you seen IRMAP's image of me with the other holy offices or the four faces?
I saw the image, but not the, you said, not the
moving
one or not the new updated heraldry.
Well, he has me, and he has the four McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, Luce, but then he has me in the middle with a big five. Well, B.O.B. adds up to 19.
Oh, yeah.
19.5 is rubbing it in, Pentatic Bob, on the way to the hexatic.
Yeah.
So I was strange attracted here. You know, brought right where I should be.
Yeah, I was thinking about the 19, actually, for a couple of reasons. One of them was that another minor Zenocrony today, I picked up a $2 copy of Field of Dreams, the movie, just because I hadn't seen it in so long, and my lady friend had never seen it, so sometime we'll watch that movie. But that's about, it's about the 1919 World Series, and I picked that up today, and then when I got the newspaper and read the business section for the, like, you know, if there's one section I never read, it's the business section. Well, no, the condo section is what I never read, but anyway, business is interesting enough. I don't usually read it at the point, but there was just Field of Dreams was mentioned as a metaphor in one of the articles in there. Like, they're talking about some project of starting up some bank or finance corporation, and like, but it wasn't a Field of Dreams, not a if you build it, they will come situation. Like, they didn't come, and it failed. So just minor little, okay, yeah, I got the movie, and then it's mentioned in the newspaper, and it's about Shoeless Joe Jackson. I believe it was the 1919 World Series that they accused them of throwing that series and threw all those guys out of Major Leagues forever.
Right. Now you remember Louis Farrakhan, mid-90s, big Million Man March in Washington?
Mm.
And he gathered together. Yeah, I mean, a lot of African Americans went to Washington and listened to him and speak, and other speakers, but the thing that the non-supporters of Louis Farrakhan went on about is that he became a nut in his speech, and he went on about the number 19 and how that was a secret Freemasonic white man number, and it's riddled.
Really?
Yeah. So he was actually parodying you know, the Bob thing. Bob was all through the history of white man, if you add 19 up as Bob, right?
Wow.
And
yeah.
Go Google that, see if you can get a transcript. He goes on about the conspiracy of 19.
Yeah, I will.
Neat thing about the word Hawaii is, you know, how are ya? How are ya? It's like the ultimate static statement. You know, how are ya?
It's kind of ultimate, like, more New York than New York.
Yes.
How are ya?
Good point. Yeah, it's a New Yorker being phatic.
Yeah.
So it's natural to go from New York to Hawaii.
Yeah, especially if we're anticipating, you know, the contact or something.
Yes, yeah.
They say, how are you?
Well, that's interesting. The guy who takes these incredible pictures of the turtles and everything, he's been swimming in a secret place for 18 years, so only he gets to talk to the turtles, and they come up to him, the same turtles. He takes pictures of the same turtles every day. They come to him and communicate. They put their head up right up against his camera, you know. And but in light of the UFO resonance here, he sent something different. He calls it cloud ships. And it is...
cloud ships?
Yeah, cloud ships, S-H-I-P-S. And he says, amazing clouds, lenticularis, L-E-N-T-I-C-U-L-A-R-I-S, are stationary lens-shaped clouds that form at high altitudes, normally aligned at right angles to the wind direction. and these incredible pictures of these huge clouds that all look like they're amazing UFOs. It says these clouds are formed by so-called mountain waves of air created by strong winds forced over high mountains. Then they hang over the mountains like alien motherships. Mount Rainier in Washington produces some of the most spectacular lenticulars. So, they're looking at them. They're incredible. I'll have to send them out. But they, there's your UFO theme around Hawaii, though these aren't necessarily Hawaiian-sourced. Anyways, UFOs came into my head today. Now you've reinforced it. Okay, so what is the next theme we want to develop? Have you got any?
What is the next theme?
Did we finish David Foster Wallace, Infinite Jest? Infinite Jest, the new thing.
One thing I could, if you're about to say something?
Yeah, well, I then started to think about how Harold Bloom, why you would like to send him the Book of the Subgenius.
Oh, yeah. Well, Well, you know what? Let's ignore the Subgenius.
Okay. All right.
We were talking about that before, and I couldn't go into it as well right now as I did then. So
okay.
I'll just mention something else that more along the lines of, if David Foster Wallace is a novelist that expresses something about the state of the novel in America, as much as that might be an expression of obsolescence, I did really enjoy his novel Infinite Jest when I read it, but I was more of a fan over the years of a novelist by the name of Bret Easton Ellis, who wrote the American Psycho that movie was made out of, but his best book is one of his only books that hasn't been made into a movie called Glamorama. And he's got, over the course of his writing career, he's got some books that take place in L.A., and they have this very kind of glassy-eyed Valium feeling to them, and they seem to be mostly about conveying that and the kind of ethical abyss or something of that world, but American Psycho takes place in New York, and Glamorama begins in New York and then goes over to Europe, and I think comes back to New York, but and so his New York books have a very different feeling, and Glamorama is very interesting. It's got this impressive ending that I remember at least the very last fragment of it. The character is looking at some kind of a painting on the wall, and his name is Victor, which I always found pretty ironic. He's looking at a painting on the wall of a mountain, and the book ends with him thinking to himself, the future is that mountain, and that those are the last words of the book. And then I read an interview with Bret Easton Ellis at some point where he said about Glamorama, said, when I started this book, I knew that the first word was going to be specs, and that the last word was going to be mountain, and that the book would be a progression from one to the other. And so in a way, it sounds like, it kind of almost sounds like the guy who's looking at your chart and was like, okay, I'm going to plot a reappearance drama out of being the specs to the mountain.
Yeah, that's good. Now, that was Glamorama?
Glamorama.
Oh, Glamour.
That's into the David Bowie glam thing. Cause whereas in American Psycho, takes place at the end of the 80s, and the character is like some kind of an ultimate yuppie as an American icon.
Yeah.
The main character in Glamorama is taking place towards the end of the 90s, and the main character is a successful, like, super successful model, like it boy of the moment, opening up his own club in New York while also being on the cover of the biggest fashion magazine. And so it's that character as an ultimate American character. And what was I going to say about that? I'm not sure I remember. Oh, yeah, Glamorama. So his world is the his world is the world of, like, there's an incredible number of celebrities' names that show up in this book.
Right.
Like, he's always describing, in the same way that American Psycho had a lot of these long passages of him just going on and on about the amenities of his apartment or his daily routine and, like, how much money and products are involved in everything.
Yeah.
Glamorama has a lot of these long, banal sections where he's just endlessly describing, like, what celebrities are somewhere.
Okay, so the last line, can you say the sentence again? It ends with mountain?
The book ends, and to me it's far and away his best book, the book ends with, the future is that mountain.
Hmm. Okay, so as you're saying that, I'm looking at the Wikipedia on David Foster Wallace.
Hmm.
So he was born February 21st, which is 221.
Hmm.
122 backwards.
I certainly didn't know that.
And he has your number, 1962, 9110-6218, Thompson Quadrant. He dies September 12th. That's 9-3, or 9-2 is 11-1. But then you add up 2 and 8 of 2008, you get 10. It's 1, so it becomes 22. His end day is 22. Says he was an American novelist, essayist, and short story writer, as well as professor at Pomona College in Claremont, California.
Pomona College?
Oh, yeah, that's the Inland Empire, isn't it?
Yeah, the bus to Pomona.
Good one.
What?
Yeah, I didn't know he was a professor. I guess, you don't make any money writing it. You don't get, listen to this. Wallace was best known for his 1996 novel, Infinite Jest, which Time included in its list of 100 best English language novels. So even if you wrote a great novel, you still got to teach in Claremont.
Yeah.
And it's Pomona. Maybe, what do you make of what David Bowie was coming back from? What was Dale Cooper involved in Twin Peaks? Was it occult research, going into the Black Lodge?
David Bowie definitely carries an air of being a alarming Black Lodge-ish figure.
Anyway,
maybe not necessarily black opposed to white, but like the more like a Negi as opposed to Bob in the Subgenius mythology. But
yeah, or an Aleister Crowley.
Yeah,
as opposed
powerful and sinister.
Yeah. Yeah, Aleister Crowley as opposed to Bob's Wyndham Lewis or James Joyce or whatever.
Mm.
Remember, we talked about this. Maybe,
yeah.
We talked about Wyndham Lewis satirizing Crowley in Apes of God,
mm-hmm.
and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any notes there? Unless you want to talk more about Twin Peaks and the synchronicity there. I mean, X-Files, the guy who made the figure of me with the four people is Earmap. And I got a message in 1993 after moving to New York City. He leaves a message on my answer machine. Bob, you've got to see this X-Files. It just started in 93, I think. He said, you got to see it. It's all the stuff you talked about and did in the 80s on TKLN. It's now a major TV show.
Yeah.
I don't know if you related that. I mean, you've got this X-Files. Was that an influence in the dream?
Oh, yeah. That was the...
The beginning. It was
an X-Files movie.
Yeah, that's right. At the beginning, and then it became something else, the process of making it.
Because while you were on the radio there, I remember hearing some of those shows where, you're talking about Twin Peaks as if it's the TV show of, like you said to, I think someone, I forget his name, like Denny or something, who had just come back from Germany, and he was unplugged from everything, and you were telling him, yeah, like, Twin Peaks, it's all about what we're doing here at CKLN, it's all about Bob and killing people.
Yes.
And so then that makes sense, then, if the X-Files is the successor to that as the show that seems to be what's about what Bob's talking about, that it would be an X-Files movie that David Bowie would show up in that would have a totally strange climax of asking that question.
Good point. Yeah. See, I hadn't connected, hadn't thought of it, unless I did 10 years ago, haven't thought about the thought. X-Files was the McDonaldization of the Twin Peaks, Black Lodge stuff. You know, it was made, extended. I mean, Lynch includes all kinds of other things. He really is showing Quadrophenia in a very simple way. But it begins with Blue Velvet. The Mae Brusselson scenario, this little town whose cops and sort of unsavory characters were involved in major dope dealing, you know, drug dealing just below the surface, just right next to you, next door to you. And the scene where you see, is it Dean somebody? Who's the actor who sings?
Dean Stockwell?
Yeah, I guess it's Dean Stockwell. Or the other guy that looks like Dean Stockwell. But he's in the house that Dennis Hopper visits, and he sings the Roy Orbison song. The two fat women in the background. That is totally, to me, Garrett Dean's home. That's the atmosphere of Garrett Dean. And we do Who's Forgotten Furry Lynn 2 years later, me and Neufeld, as a Radio Night special, just at the last minute spontaneously whipped together some tapes and he brought some records. But we opened with Garrett Dean, and then, now it's in my mind for 2 years that the Blue Velvet, the Roy Orbison song is sung in a Garrett Dean environment. So we're listening to the first 8 minutes or so of Garrett with me and Carolyn, and right when the point I go, Garrett's done a rant or something, and I said, that's Garrett's guitar solo. I say something like that. And right then, Neufeld, without me commanding, I don't think, he puts on his first contribution, a song that he brought down. And it is the Blue Velvet song sung in the Garrett house. You know,
oh, wow.
The candy-colored blah, blah, blah. Guy peeps into your, tiptoes into your room, you know, that candy-colored Sandman or something?
I don't remember it that well, but...
It's a great song, and so... The xenocrony of Lynch and what he did follows me from Blue Velvet on, and not even planned. I mean, Dave plays the song that is the Garrett song from Blue Velvet right after I finished the Garrett. Or I don't even know if I singled him. He just decided to stop it. And what happens is I go, let's hear Garrett's guitar solo, or I say, that was Garrett's guitar. No, I think I go, let's hear Garrett's guitar solo. And the next thing you hear is the strum of the guitar as Roy Orbison's song starts. And it becomes Garrett's home, the thing that reminded me from Blue Velvet. So then 2 years later, Twin Peaks comes out in 90, and then that's all direct references me of what I was doing that week. And then the movie version, Firewalk with Me. Now, have you seen my YouTube dance?
Yeah, I did.
Well, if you notice, it begins with me crouching. I'm standing in the lit window, and then I approach the camera, and then I waddle back, deftly waddle back, and I crouch down, just like the first time you see, I think it's in the movie, the first image that Laura Palmer sees of Bob, the bad Bob, and he's crouched down in the corner of her bedroom. Well, that's what I did. In this YouTube that is going to become huge because the record company loves it. And I've got the Bob thing there consciously. But it all started 22 years ago in 86 with the Blue Velvet. And so then you have The Lost Highway, which is more of me. Then you have Mulholland Drive, which is more of me. I'm not going to go into the details. But as I say these things, is there any xenocronies that you think of in Lynch movies in relation to me or other things in your life?
Well, he's got Absurda as his distribution company.
Ah, very good, very good. Yes, Absurda. Is that recently? That's recently, isn't it?
Yeah, at least on Inland Empire. I don't know about any of the other stuff.
Yeah, now Inland Empire really sums up the four bodies. That really does sum up a lot of what's been worked out since 86 by him. But what do you see in Eraserhead? Do you see all these things in Eraserhead? Do you know that Eraserhead is a good definition for the Android meme? Because the Android meme is always erasing things.
Like erased Terrence McKenna's library, apparently, did you say?
No, not that. It's just that, you know, in 24 hours, who remembers what they saw 8 hours ago on TV? You know, the rapidity of information exchange, information movement and jumping from one scene to another. That is, that's the essence of the Android meme, and that's Eraserhead. It erases.
Yeah. Okay.
So he intuited, and that movie, maybe I should just wiki it. See, I think it's made in 76, but comes out in 77. Not sure. Okay, Eraserhead is a 1977 surrealist horror film written and directed by David Lynch. Okay. On my chart, the Android meme begins in 77, and it's immediately named by the Android meme via Lynch's movie Eraserhead.
Okay.
It's that kind of rapid self-reflexivity that goes on from that point on. It's the beginning of special effects movies. You know, it's Star Wars? Close Encounters?
Yeah.
So, So Lynch tapped in. You know what Zappa said? He used to say that Freaks was his favorite movie. And that's, have you ever seen Freaks?
No.
Made in the 30s about weird circus people. It's fictional.
No.
But that was his favorite movie for 10, 15 years. But then later he said his favorite movie, I don't know if it was his favorite new movie, but his favorite movie was Eraserhead.
Mm.
And Zappa describes himself as a guy at a toll booth as people went into hyperspace.
Toll booth. That's nice. The well, that reminds me, actually, there's an episode of The X-Files that's about freaks or circus sideshow performers that way, and it's a very...
Are you there? Okay, we got knocked off again. Ad Absurdum was just commenting on the X-Files in relation to Zappa liking the Freaks movie. What was that?
That there was an episode of the X-Files once where they, that had to do with a murder mystery among a bunch of sideshow performers or freaks, and that particular episode of the X-Files had a lot of overtones to the script of dealing with the kind of themes that I would associate with the Church of the Subgenius a bit, in the sense that it's this community of people who are making a living, some of them off of out of bamboozling people, and there were a lot of good things in the script that way, of the kind of psychology and ethics back and forth of that type of a carnival entertainment, and not just I don't necessarily mean just bamboozling people, but also those certain carnival barker, step right up, grabbing your attention salesman rant kind of theme there that reminds me of the Subgenius.
Okay, the interesting thing about irony, maybe is what Bob Black was getting at, is that if you state that you know you're being a jerk rather than just blindly being a jerk, then you can get away with it. And so it's the knowing factor, or what people call awareness, that is the final alibi of life under Android meme conditions. Because actually consciousness, as shown on my charts, the fourth level, it's not the final quadrant, final level, consciousness itself is impossible today. So, using McLuhan's principle that the previous environment becomes an art form, being conscious and experiencing the normal consciousness of a human being, which is doubleness, you're living and you're aware you're living. And you're aware of what that person's doing to you, and you're aware that they're aware that you're aware that they're doing it. That kind of doubleness is not possible anymore, because we're impaled, like the flat description of the Android meme you were talking about. What was that? The flatness. What was that? The dream? I forget the source of the flat image you were talking about, and I interpret that as the Android meme. You know, about an hour or two ago, you the flat. I don't know if it was a dream image, but this flat, the mathematics, the flat math or something, the flat.
I can't even remember it.
Okay.
I, for some reason, my brain will not give me the answer.
Yeah, remember I was saying that Croker talked about the flat Pomo surface? And anyways, the flatness, the best you can have is a pinhead of consciousness. But okay, so if we're in the no zone, post-information society, then the only thing we can know is the previous environment, which is simple consciousness and doubleness. So that's the alibi. If you are showing that you're aware of what you're doing, even if it's evil, then people will let it ride. Because consciousness as a figure, obsolete figure, is a sign of being whatever, human or whatever. So I just thought of that as you were mentioning the Church Subgenius, that their alibi, they
the
are...
excuse.
That's their excuse. That's their old-fashionedness. They don't dare to be nothing. They claim to be nothing, claim to be, you know, the joke is we're anti-art, anti-business. We're a religion that's anti-religion. We're a business that's anti-business. We're an art that's anti-art.
Yeah.
We're this that's an anti-this. So that
we're comedians that aren't kidding.
Yes. So that is the final alibi of the establishment. That's what James, that George Bush and Cheney ride on. They know, you know that they know that they're fooling you, but that means they're legitimate.
Yeah, it's that great, the great moment of. Truly great moment of the much celebrated Stephen Colbert's Bush roast.
Yes,
is just when he says, "But I get it."
Good, yeah, that's it.
Get it?
Yeah,
you know?
That's the tone. And so, getting it means you're human.
What?
You are aware of yourself. As we move into post-human consciousness, that's what humans rely on, and that's probably what Bob Black, who we mentioned off air. Was getting at when he criticized the Church Subgenius as a dupe of the Age of Irony.
Mm.
But if you bring back in McLuhan language, it just wraps it up so nicely, so simply, and fits into the pattern of history of previous environments becoming art forms. So, I hope you...
Yeah, and McLuhan preaches slack, too, so there you go.
Yeah.
Like having, you know, retaining your own, I guess... To him, it would be like keeping the faith that your private citadel of consciousness is not fundamentally affected and that you can always choose to understand.
Right, even though that smacks a bit of the doubleness there, of being of relying on your faith, which is not affected, relying on your private citadel of consciousness, not affected by media.
But so when you said that that it's the final alibi of the establishment, that's absolutely... right, in the sense that you know, perhaps the as much as the subgenia, I try to build up a comprehensive immune system of not, you know, trying to say we refuse to let this religion become its own enemy by, you know, decaying or getting too rigid on its symbols. You know, they have all these things about deniability of doctrine and, or erasability, actually, of doctrine and all this kind of stuff, and you must form your own schismatic heretic clinch and all that kind of thing, that even if none of the symbols are really adhered to, that it could be that just that you could actually just become addicted to that type of ironic excuse making.
Yes, and
but
that
then on the other hand, what better content is there?
Well,
maybe there is better content, but as far as comedy anyway, or like a very hyper self-aware comedy, there's really no other pole to reach for.
So the better than that is not needing any comedy, not needing anything. That might be better.
Mm.
And taking whatever you get is the best you could get.
Yeah.
So that is the fate of the Canadian against the monolith American subgenius. the Canadian.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could agree with that, but something about not needing it, and yet I would still, you know, recommend, like, for example, tonight's Stephen Colbert show was really hilarious. It's great to get some good laughs.
Right, it's interesting how one can remember things that are funny and laugh at them, but after a while it runs out and you need new input. So you turn the TV back on. So that's why McLuhan said you don't get rid of technology, just modulate it.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's the Sub-Dini, that's the Sub-Dini view, the Canadian counterblast to the American Sub-Genie addiction.
Yeah, it's Slack via media ecology.
Yeah. And we're doing the same thing as everybody else, but we know we're doing it and can explain it and can even erase the importance of knowing it with our explanation.
And can trick the hyper-self-aware people into reacting as if there's no way you know that you're doing that.
That's right. And trick them into hating, and then relying on Coker's stubborn resistance as their final fortress.
Yeah. Well, they say that Bob can sell. Bob is such a great salesman that he can even sell hate to some geniuses, and I would agree.
Yep.
It seems to be indicated. Seems to be necessary and needed. And on that note, I am going to need to have to modulate the cell phone off of my head, and it's late at night here in Toronto. And
right. I just want to say, did you say indicated or vindicated?
No, I said indicated with no V.
Right.
That selling hate to subgeniuses would seem to be the you know, what's needed or something to feed the fires of the human stubbornness.
Right, and that's presenting the Canadian sense of being nice people in a new way, so that we become vicious, vicious Canadians.
We sacrifice ourselves to sell you hate.
Yes. Okay. All right, thanks a lot, Ad Absurdum. Very good. I hope to have some more talk with you.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, and thank you, Scott. Look forward to hearing it.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Good night.
Good night.